Welcome to The Debate. If you watch a time-lapse video of a modern city expanding, I mean, it looks remarkably like a biological organism eating.
Oh, it really does.
Right? You see the forests cleared, the earth hollowed out, materials drawn into the center, and the borders just kind of creeping outward. It is a massive, ceaseless metabolism. And, you know, if you are part of that system, you eventually have to ask, is this the only way a civilization can operate?
Well, it is certainly the most efficient way we have found so far. You have a system that consumes inputs, raw resources, human labor, time, attention.
Yeah, exactly.
From a strictly operational standpoint, that is just the fundamental law of biological and institutional survival. I mean, if you don't consume, you die.
But what if eating wasn't inherently about devouring? Today, we are examining a really fascinating 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Sali. It's titled, From Consumption to Communion, Eucharistic Ontology, Predatory Civilization, and the Life-Giving Body of Christ.
It is a profound piece of work.
It really is. It takes this unstoppable eating machinery of our world and asks a pretty disruptive question. What if the most foundational metabolism of reality wasn't extraction, but self-gift?
Right.
So I will be arguing today that the paper's Eucharistic pattern of take, bless, break, give provides a highly practical and frankly desperately needed counter logic to restructure our currently extractive societal systems.
And I will be taking the opposing view, because while Dr. Saheli offers a brilliant, almost forensic critique of modern consumption, expecting human secular institutions to operate on the irreducibly divine principle of total self-gift, well, it stretches a beautiful theology way beyond its breaking point.
You think it's just not practical?
Exactly. Institutions are not divine. They are biological and organizational machines that absolutely must consume to survive.
Well, let's start with that forensic critique, because the diagnosis here is foundational. The core thesis of the paper is that modern civilization excels at one thing above all else, which is consumption without communion.
Yes.
And the paper brings up this biological concept called autopoiesis, which in biology, autopoiesis is just the process by which a system maintains and reproduces itself. A cell keeps its walls intact, a plant photosynthesizes to stay alive.
Right. Self-creation and self-maintenance. It is a neutral, entirely necessary function of life.
Exactly. But the paper illustrates how our modern institutional systems have mutated this concept into something deeply predatory. They have become these autopoietic loops that convert the living world into fuel solely for their own endless expansion.
Meaning they eat everything around them.
Yes, it happens everywhere. We have an economy that consumes human labor without actually nourishing the laborer. We have digital ecosystems designed to capture and literally consume human attention. We have an industrial model that consumes the biosphere.
Mm-hmm.
They all operate on this anti-Eucharistic logic, treating life merely as an object to be devoured.
See, I don't disagree with the diagnosis of the disease at all. Calling our modern structural framework a destructive eater of flesh is razor sharp.
Right, it's a great phrase.
It is. If you look at the architecture of a major social media platform, it is quite literally designed to strip mine human psychology for engagement metrics. But identifying a disease doesn't mean the proposed cure is viable.
Okay, how so?
Well, the paper explicitly roots its alternative in the biblical narrative, specifically the scandal of John 6,
where Christ tells his followers they must eat his flesh and drink his blood.
Yes. And in that text, he isn't just offering a nice moral framework about sharing. He is offering his actual self, his life, as food.
Right.
This level of total self-emptying, this completely non-dominating power, it is intrinsically tied to the theological concepts of the cross and the resurrection. It is a uniquely divine attribute. You cannot simply map that divine dynamic onto secular institutional frameworks, whether that is, you know, corporate governance, global supply chains, or even municipal infrastructure.
But why not? Why can't a hospital or a supply chain adopt a logic of self-gift?
Because of the autopoiesis you just mentioned.
Wait, let me...
No, think about it. If an institution, say a massive global shipping conglomerate, does not prioritize its own self-maintenance, it collapses, it goes bankrupt. Think of that biological cell again. A cell must maintain its semi-permeable membrane. It has to consume energy from outside itself to fight off entropy.
Sure.
If the cell decides to be entirely broken open and given to the surrounding environment, it dissolves. It ceases to exist. When you demand that a human institution follow the Eucharistic pattern of total self-gift, you are essentially demanding structural suicide. You are applying a theology of martyrdom to a system that, quite frankly, just needs to pick up the trash on Tuesdays.
Aha. But you're assuming that structure and extraction are the exact same thing, and they really aren't. A skeleton provides structure to a body without eating the surrounding organs.
Well,
and the paper is actually very careful here. It doesn't claim that self-maintenance is intrinsically evil. Coherent organization is required to serve anyone at all. The pathology, the actual predation, arises when institutional self-preservation becomes completely detached from the living purpose that justified the institution in the first place.
Okay, give me a concrete example of that detachment.
Think about the healthcare system. A hospital is built to heal the sick. That is its living purpose. To do that, yes, it needs administration, billing, and structural maintenance.
Right.
But at a certain point, the autopoietic drive takes over. The system's survival and expansion become paramount, so the hospital begins to treat patients merely as throughput to maximize billing codes.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors are squeezed to see more patients in less time just to satisfy shareholder returns. The human being, both the patient and the doctor, becomes fuel for the institution's growth. The institution starts consuming the host.
And your argument is that a Eucharistic framework fixes this without destroying the hospital's ability to keep the lights on?
Yes, because it demands a fundamental inversion of metrics. It redefines what success looks like. If you're listening to this and you work in middle management, you've probably felt this autopoietic trap firsthand, you know?
Oh, I'm sure many have.
You've probably asked yourself, why am I enforcing this policy when it actively hurts our clients or my team? The Eucharistic alternative isn't about the hospital destroying itself. It's about shifting the metric from power as accumulation to power as service.
But how does that actually look?
Well, a hospital can be robust, well-funded, and highly organized, but its metabolism is different. It gathers resources not to hoard them or protect elite privilege, but to distribute healing justly. It takes, yes, but it receives as a gift, blesses it, and shares it.
See, that sounds incredible in a boardroom mission statement. But let's look at the actual mechanics of how these systems enforce their rules. Because this brings me to a much deeper structural problem, which is the reality of coercion.
Okay.
Dr. Saheli's paper leans heavily into the idea that human societies historically stabilize themselves through mimetic violence and scapegoating.
Yes, the idea that when a community is fracturing, they unconsciously find an outgroup or a victim to blame. They channel all their collective aggression into punishing that scapegoat, which creates a temporary violent peace.
Exactly. And the paper argues that Christ disrupts this cycle. He doesn't defeat the devouring world by devouring it back. The Eucharist represents a power that absolutely refuses to coerce. It is purely an invitation. It is total non-domination.
Which is a profound structural intervention.
Theologically, yes, absolutely. Practically, civilizationally, it is a paradox. Translate that pure non-coercion to the architecture of a state. How do you operate a legal or political system without coercion? Well, a legal system inherently requires the threat of domination to function. It needs fines, imprisonment, and ultimately, a state monopoly on violence to enforce laws and protect the vulnerable from actual predators.
Right, but
if a state cannot use coercive force, it cannot stop a literal corporate monopoly from poisoning a river or a violent criminal from causing harm. So if we follow the logic of the paper, does a legal institution become anti-Eucharistic simply because it forcefully stops a predator?
No, and I actually think that's a misreading of how the paper redefines justice. The paper doesn't call for some utopian anarchist abolition of law. If you look at Appendix A, the Eucharistic diagnostic questions, there is a highly specific metric for power and governance. It asks, does this authority make others more fully alive?
But
let me finish this thought. The paper argues that law must become the protection of communion.
But protection implies a wall. It implies force.
Let's use a mechanical metaphor here. Think of how we normally view the law. It operates like a fence. A fence is designed to keep the wolves out, but it also isolates the sheep, it divides the property, and it is fundamentally about protecting assets by threatening violence against trespassers.
Sure.
The Eucharistic framework asks us to view the law more like an immune system within a living body. An immune system does neutralize threats, it does stop infections, but its entire underlying logic is the restoration of health to the whole body.
Okay. An immune system.
Right. Right now, so much of our legal structure is designed to protect property without life, or to enforce rigid procedures without mercy. When a legal system shifts its ultimate goal from merely enforcing rules and dealing out vengeance to restoring right relation, the coercion it uses is fundamentally transformed. It becomes bounded by the mandate to heal rather than the mandate to dominate.
That is an elegant theory. It really is. But look at the reality of human behavior. Restoring right relation often requires imposing your will on someone who has no desire to be in right relation.
Well, sometimes yes.
When the paper says Christ enters the logic of devouring flesh not to conquer by force but to transform by love, it is speaking of an eschatological divine reality. The state is not Christ.
No, of course not.
When a legal system stops an exploitative tech monopoly, it is conquering by force. It is dismantling that monopoly against its will. My concern is that by labeling the highest ideal as this non-coercive self-gift, we leave secular institutions in an impossible moral bind. They are forever condemned as predatory simply for exercising the basic messy functions required to maintain order in a profoundly flawed world.
You are assuming the paper expects perfection, but it actually provides a diagnostic tool for continuous correction. It isn't condemning all authority. It is demanding that authority be endlessly scrutinized. But, you know, if we assume, as you seem to, that secular law can never transcend the management of objects by force, it is no wonder we treat the physical earth the exact same way.
Ah.
Which leads us to the cosmic and ecological dimensions of this paper, which I think brilliantly bridge the gap between the material realities you're concerned with and the theology.
You're talking about the section on the cosmic Eucharist?
Yes. The paper points out that the bread and wine brought to the altar are not just simple magical objects that drop from the sky. They carry the seed, the soil, the sunlight, the water, and the sweat of human labor.
Right. The material reality.
Exactly. They contain the entire physical supply chain. The paper argues that ecological responsibility has to move away from these sterile, technocratic sustainability targets we constantly miss, and move toward a posture of reverence and thanksgiving. It fundamentally changes the primary question of civilization.
From what to what?
Instead of asking, what is the maximum amount we can extract sustainably without the system crashing, we should be asking, how do we receive the physical world as a gift and return it as praise?
Now, I will readily concede that the shift from extraction to reverence is vital. If we continue to treat the biosphere as an infinite inventory of parts, we are going to go extinct. But, and here is my issue, the paper takes this ecological reverence and pushes it into a concept of mutual indwelling.
Mm-hmm.
It claims we need a life coherence where everyone and everything is recognized as part of one body. Here is my practical, on-the-ground reservation with that. We live in a highly pluralistic, deeply fractured world. The vast majority of the global population does not share the theological premise of being one body in Christ.
They don't have to share the theological premise to experience the biological reality of mutual interdependence, though.
But how do you implement a civilizational vision of communion without it becoming a coercive collectivism?
Well,
I mean, if the state or the dominant culture starts dictating what counts as nourishing or what fits the definition of Eucharistic life coherence, doesn't that risk becoming a new form of domination? It sounds dangerously close to a theocracy draped in the warm, inviting language of communion. Who gets to decide what is a gift and what is extraction?
That is a completely valid fear, and the paper actually anticipates it directly. It explicitly states that this type of civilization cannot be imposed by domination, because domination contradicts the Eucharistic form.
Okay, but
the entire mechanism of the Eucharist is free reception. You cannot force someone to accept a gift. Otherwise, it's just a disguised form of control. Therefore, a Eucharistic civilization cannot be a top-down theocratic mandate. It must grow organically from the bottom up.
But how does a bottom-up philosophical shift actually change a multi-billion dollar extractive industry?
By providing communities with the vocabulary to demand different metrics. It functions as a qualitative standard for human flourishing rather than a legislative hammer. When the paper asks us to look at an economic arrangement and ask who is fed by this and who or what is consumed by it, those are questions that pierce straight through pluralistic boundaries. You do not need to be a Christian theologian to recognize when a local working class community is being consumed by a predatory industrial plant or when a watershed is being destroyed for short-term shareholder profit.
That's true.
The Eucharistic ontology just gives us the deepest, most resonant vocabulary to name exactly why that is wrong. It exposes the hidden religion of extraction and shows us what the alternative metabolism must look like.
As a diagnostic vocabulary, I grant that it is piercing. Those questions in the appendix, things like, does this technology deepen real presence or does it substitute for it? Are our institutions forming consumers of services or members of a living body? Those are the kind of questions every CEO and city planner should absolutely be forced to answer.
Exactly.
But I still maintain my original stance. There is an irreducible gap between the kingdom of God and the city of man. The paper tells us that Christ doesn't overcome predation by becoming a stronger predator. He overcomes it by becoming food.
Right.
It is a breathtaking reality for faith. Yet, in the material biological world we inhabit, if an institution just becomes food, it gets eaten by the wolves. The survival of complex human systems requires a degree of boundary maintenance, self-protection, and structural autopoiesis that the pure divine self-gift of the Eucharist fundamentally transcends.
And I would counter that our modern obsession with boundary maintenance and infinite self-protective growth is exactly what is driving us towards civilizational and ecological collapse. We are so terrified of being eaten that we are devouring the world. The wolves you are worried about aren't outside the walls. They are the very systems we built ourselves.
So where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us with a profound tension, which I think we've both really illuminated today. To synthesize my position, I believe Dr. Solly's paper provides a radical and entirely practical framework for treating the structural disease of consumption without communion.
Right.
It proves that this theology isn't just private spiritual consolation, you know? It is a lens for seeing the true mechanics of reality. By demanding that our economies, our technologies, and our legal systems prioritize actual nourishment and life coherence over mindless extraction, it offers one of the few viable pathways out of the predatory cycles that are currently failing us.
And to synthesize my view, I agree that Dr. Saheli's diagnosis is a masterpiece of cultural and structural critique. Our modern institutional systems truly are operating as destructive eaters of flesh.
Definitely.
But I remain cautious about the sheer mechanics of the prescription. The Eucharistic civilization remains a profound theological mystery pointing to the divine. When we try to seamlessly translate the uncompromising machinery of the secular world into a sacrament of total self-emptying, we risk asking flawed human institutions to achieve something only God can do.
Yet despite that disagreement on the implementation, we both clearly converge on the brilliance of the diagnosis itself. There is an undeniable, urgent need to reconnect the act of consumption with gratitude, limits, and shared life.
Absolutely.
The systems we participate in every single day are designed to devour us, and honestly, naming that reality out loud is the crucial first step toward dismantling it.
I completely agree. The tension we've explored today between the beautiful divine ideal of total self-gift and the cold structural reality of institutional survival forces a critical reevaluation of what our societal systems are actually designed to do. It wakes us up. It stops us from blindly accepting extraction as an unavoidable law of nature.
I highly encourage listeners to look closely at those Eucharistic diagnostic questions in Appendix A of the paper. You don't need to be a theologian to use them. Take them into your workplace, your community, or your next board meeting.
It's a great exercise.
It really is. Evaluate the economic systems and the digital technologies you interact with every day and ask yourself a very simple question. Am I receiving life as a gift here, or am I being conditioned to grasp it as a possession?
It is a text that demands deep reflection, regardless of your background. It challenges the very architecture of how human beings live together.
Think back to that time-lapse image of the city expanding, devouring the surrounding landscape just to sustain its own relentless growth. We are standing inside that exact metabolism right now. The question Dr. Sahoy's paper leaves us with is whether we are doomed to eventually be consumed by it, or if society can truly learn a new way to eat, whether we can finally cross the threshold from consumption into communion.